hold on tight and hope that all that butter weren't going to try to fight its way back out of my throat. Big and hard as it had got, it wouldn't probably come back out without a whole lot of choking involved. I wanted to holler up at Mr. Leroy that maybe he was running Jingle Boy too hard. But like he told me, it was like a ball had started rolling down a hill and weren't about to be stopped. After the longest time, I could smell water, and Mr. Leroy eased up some on Jingle Boy. I opened my eyes and saw we were in Windsor, at the end of a road that had a big ferry sitting on the river. Me and Mr. Leroy jumped off, and once things inside of me quit shaking, I patted Jingle Boy's chest. He was sweating something fierce and breathing hard, like it was a cold, cold winter day. He looked at me like he was wondering how come I let Mr. Leroy pound him that way. His eyes were wild as a hurt deer's. I said, "Mr. Leroy, sir, we ran Jingle Boy way too hard. He's about to die, sir. I best take him down into the river and water him and cool him off." Mr. Leroy said, "Depends on when that ferry's leaving. You go ask them white men. Horse gonna be fine. Y'all up here baby him too much." I said, "Yes, sir. But maybe you should take him down to the river, Mr. Leroy. And maybe you should take a dip, too. You're sweating just as much as Jingle Boy." I didn't tell him, but his eyes were looking just as wild as the horse's, too. The white men said the ferry weren't leaving for 45 minutes. I told Mr. Leroy and took Jingle Boy right on into the river. He dropped his head down and drank long and hard, blowing bubbles up all round his mouth. I found a bucket with the hole in it and used it to scoop water up on his flanks. They shivered and shook, but I knowed he liked it. After a while, he quit drinking and started breathing regular. Mr. Leroy called out, "Elijah, bring that horse on up here. We gotta be first on, so's we's first off." I took Jingle Boy back up to the landing and told Mr. Leroy, "Sir, it ain't no use to run Jingle Boy this hard. If he dies or pulls up lame, it's going to take us twice as long to get up to that village and 3 times as long to get back to Buxton. I know this horse, sir, and he ain't up to hours of hard running like this." Mr. Leroy looked out across the river at Detroit. He said, "I suppose you're right. We ain't going to push him as much from here on." That near about took my breath away. Those were words of respect. Here I want nothing but a child, and he saw what I said was right and agreed to go along with my plan. I guess it's like what Cooter's ma said, that I'm a lot more grown and smarter than most folks my age. Once we got off the ferry in Detroit, I looked back over to Canada. I ain't disputing that I'm a whole lot smarter than most other children who are near about 12 years old. But I couldn't for anything see how come a river made so much difference. How could one side of the river mean you were free and the other side mean you were a slave? When you looked at the trees in Canada and the trees in America, they seemed to be the same trees, like they could have come out of one seed. Same with the rocks and the houses and the horses, and everything else that I could compare. But the grown folks could see big differences that weren't plain to me. Mr. Leroy kept his word, and whilst the shaking was still worse than it would have been on old Flapjack, it was tolerable better than the ride to Windsor. The logging village was about 5 or 6 times as big as the square in Buxton. Mr. Leroy told me to get the paper out that had the man's name on it who'd nursed Mr. Highgate. First person we saw that weren't white, he made me ask, "Excuse me, sir, we're looking for Mr. Benjamin Alston. He lives at 509 Wilbur Place." The man said, "That be old Benji. It's on down the road a bit, but you ain't gonna find him there. He most likely out back of the tavern this time of night.
Where's the tavern, sir?
The man pointed up the road and said, right yon. He told Mr. Leroy, that's a mighty fine horse you got there, mister. Mr. Leroy didn't answer, so I said, thank you kindly, sir. Mr. Leroy was looking hard up at the tavern. He said, what he doing out back of tavern?
They's gambling. Stakes ain't much, but it's about all the entertaining you gonna find round here.
Mr. Leroy said, you hear tell if a man from Canada would call himself preacher been gambling with anyone round here? The man laughed and said,
a preacher what owns up to sinning, huh? Ain't heard of no such man in these parts.
No, that would have stuck with me.
Mr. Leroy pulled his coat aside so the man could see the preacher's pistol and said, he's toting a gun, same as this here one.
Same holster, too.
The man smiled and said,
oh, him. Yes, sir. He was gambling up here a while back. He done cleaned all these here fools out, then went looking for some bigger fish to fry. Last I hear, he went on over to gamble with some of them white men. I don't know where they playing at, but one of them back behind the tavern would.
This was great news. Maybe the preacher had won enough by now to really buy 6 more slaves out of America. Maybe we didn't have no cause to come up here tearing after him. Mr. Leroy said,
thank you kindly.
He reached down to pull me onto Jingle Boy. 'Twere far at all to the tavern. When we got there, Mr. Leroy tied Jingle Boy out front and told me,
if there's any trouble, you light on out for this horse and go home. Just follow that road south.
I said, yes, sir. He pulled the pistol out of the holster and put it in the pocket of his waistcoat. He never took his hand back out of the pocket. We walked round back of the tavern and came up on a bunch of men squatting down and talking loud. Once we got up on them, I saw the preacher weren't there. The men were tossing 2 little white square boxes with dots all over them up against a wall. There was lots of swearing and lots of coins being passed round and American dollar bills being waved back and forth and held squozed up in fists. Mr. Leroy said,
pardon me. Any of y'all know a man named of?
He gave me a nudge. I took the paper out of my pocket again and read, Mr. Benjamin Alston. One of the men said,
who axed him?
Mr. Leroy said,
he help a friend, and I needs to talk to him.
The man said,
what friend he help?
Mr. Leroy said,
man name of Highgate, come from Buxton in Canada.
The man who'd asked all the questions stood up and said,
I'm Benji Alston. What can I do for you?
Mr. Leroy said,
thank you kindly for helping Theodore, sir.
'Twere nothing. Someone bushwhack him. All I done was give him a place to rest and call a doctor. That's one looking man. Doc say a 1/2 inch closer, he'd have been killed for sure. How we doing?
Mr. Leroy said,
I hear you might know where I can find the man who got a gun like this here one.
Mr. Leroy pulled his hand out of his pocket. He had the gun pointed back at himself so no one wouldn't get the wrong idea. A bunch of grumbling and scowls came over all the men once they saw that gun. Mr. Alston said,
ish, could none y'all say for sure he was cheating? Man might have been having a good roll of luck.
Someone said,
look my foot.
One of the other men said,
he got done with us and said he was looking to bet for some real money. Said he wanted to go up against some white folks. They was gambling over in Culpeppers, but that was earlier this week. Shoot, I figure if that man was smart enough to cheat all us,
He have to be smart enough to know better than to gamble with no white folks.
Mr. Alston said,
Last I heard, he was over at the East Lee stable yesterday. But I ain't sure I believe it. That's where them slavers is staying.
Slavers? My blood ran cold. Mr. Alston said,
Y'all best be careful. If you plan on going over to that stable, them paddle rollers there ain't to be trifled with. Got them one of the biggest, baddest bear-fighting dogs I ever seen up north.
He told us where the stable was, and I thanked him. I don't know what it was, if it was the talk about the slavers or the talk about the bear-fighting dog. But soon as we started walking back to Jingle Boy, Mr. Leroy commenced to looking mighty worried and afeard, and it tore my heart out. I said, What's wrong, Mr. Leroy? Should we go get us some help from somewhere? Mr. Leroy grabbed his left arm and started breathing like he'd just been chopping oaks. He said,
Elijah, ain't no one gonna help me. It'd just be you.
Ain't nothing in the world that'll get you feeling fragile quicker than seeing a grown person you know as hard as nails looking afeard.
But Mr. Leroy, what's wrong? Why are you looking like that?
He said,
We got to get to that stable, boy. We got to move quick.
He climbed up on Jingle Boy slow and in parts, instead of jumping up the way he regular did. He then put his arm down to pull me up. He said,
Lead the horse young, Elijah, through the back way.
I grabbed Jingle Boy's reins and led him north. We got about a half a mile when I said to Mr. Leroy,
Sir, maybe we should get you some rest before we go to that stable. Maybe we need to.
I looked back just as Mr. Leroy started sliding off of Jingle Boy. It seemed like he was moving so slow that he was sort of floating down toward the ground, like he was just going to settle soft and light as a feather. But when he landed on his face, there was a horrible heavy thump, and things commenced moving again like they normal do.
Mr. Leroy!
I ran back and kneeled down beside him. His eyes were open, but he was blinking more than he would most times. I said, Please, Mr. Leroy, please get back up. I shook him and he said,
No. You got to go in that stable and get that money, boy. He done thiefed the money for your mother and sister, Ezekiel.
Mr. Leroy was out of his mind.
I said, Please, sir, I ain't Ezekiel. I'm Elijah Freeman.
He grabbed my arm and said,
Is you gonna do it? Is you gonna get that money, boy?
I started going all fragile. Things commenced loosening in my nose. He said,
Promise me. Promise me now.
What could I do? I whispered, I ain't Ezekiel. I'm Elijah.
He said,
Promise me. Promise me you'll get that money. And if he done lost it, promise me you's gonna gut shoot him.
Please, Mr. Leroy, please get up. Please don't leave me here alone.
He said,
Son, can't you see I'm dying? Please tell me. Please tell me you's gonna get the money for your ma and sister. That ain't much. Ezekiel, how come you ain't telling me?
His voice was getting softer and softer, and that was worse than if he'd been yelling.
Finally, I said, I promise, sir. I promise I'll do it.
He smiled and whispered,
Take that pistol, boy.
I pulled the mystery pistol out of the fancy holster and put it in my tote sack. He coughed twice,
and something dark and thick started leaking out of his mouth and nose. The last things he said were, "I love you, son. Tell your ma." His eyes stayed open, but I knowed they weren't seeing nothing. I shook them and said, "Mr. Leroy? Oh, please, Mr. Leroy!" I ran back to Mr. Alston to try and get some help. I busted right in on the men and yelled, "Excuse me, sir. Mr. Leroy fell off the horse and ain't moving." Mr. Alston said, "What'd you say, boy? Calm yourself down and don't be talking that fast." I catch my breath and said, "Mr. Leroy fell off the horse and ain't breathing." They ran back with me and bunched up round where Mr. Leroy was laying. Mr. Alston looked at Mr. Leroy and put his hands over his eyes to close them. He said, "Son, he pass. Y'all kin?" "No, sir." "Y'all's both from Buxton?" "Yes, sir."
"You got anyone up here what can look after you?"
I started to say no, but note if I did, and if Mr. Leroy really was dead, they weren't going to let me keep my promise. They weren't going to let me hunt the preacher down and get Mr. Leroy's money back. I said, "Yes, sir. My auntie lives just over yon." I pointed south. Mr. Alston said, "We're going to have to get the sheriff, boy. Tell your auntie she need to come claim him, else they're going to put him in the pauper's field." I said, "I'll have to tell my pa and Buxton. They'll come and get Mr. Leroy." I grabbed Jingle Boy's reins and never looked back. A promise is a promise, and I wasn't about to let Mr. Leroy down. I was going to find the preacher if it took me 10 years, and I was going to start with the East Lee stable, so Mr. Alston and the other men wouldn't get suspicious. I headed south, pretending I was riding hard back to Buxton.
Chapter 21. Terrified in America.
I circled round and started back north. I saw the stable from 2 blocks off. There was a hitching post just down from it, so I tied Jingle Boy and commenced walking the rest of the way. I dug 5 of the chunking stones out of my tote sack and put 3 in my left hand and 2 in my right. I didn't have a notion the first what a bear-fighting dog would look like, so I hoped 5 stones would be enough in case me and it had a disagreement. As I got right on the stable, it happened in a flash. First thing that came to mind was Paul, telling me that I didn't never have to worry about no barking dog, that it was barking 'cause it was just as scared as me. He said it was the quiet dog I had to be afeard of. That was the kind of dog that weren't interested in scaring no one. It was only looking to bite something big and meaty off of you. Before I seen anything, I heard the sound of a chain rattling, then a hard grunt like something heavy was changing direction sudden-like. Other than those soft sounds, this bear-fighting dog was quiet as an owl diving at a mouse. I saw a big black blur coming at me, and at the same time as I tried to get out of the way, I throwed left, right, left, hard as I could. I heard a chain sing from getting pulled taut, and the bear-fighting dog's paws hit me square in the side so strong that the last 2 chunking stones flew out of my hand. I were nothing but a dead duck. A spray of the dog's slobber splashed on my face, and I hit the ground hard, knocking my breather right out of me. The dog still didn't bark or nothing, but his front paws pressed like fists into my ribs. All I could do was wonder if he was going to rip me apart or squeeze the life out of me by standing on my chest. I closed my eyes and waited to get suffocated or torn limb from limb. But didn't nothing happen. I opened my eyes and saw the dog was out cold. His head was lolling up against my side. The head was huge, just about the size of a 5-month-old calf's head, and was covered with scars. He was breathing fast like he'd just chased a rabbit, and little snorts of dust were blowing up with each breath he took. His feet were twitching like dogs do when they're having a nightmare. Just that quick, I noticed my ribs. It felt like someone had run a knife into them, and I looked down. The nails from one of the bear-fighting dog's front paws had disappeared into the front of my shirt, and my blood was starting to leak out. I rolled from underneath the dog's legs, then rolled twice more and laid in the dirt waiting for my breathing to catch back up to me. After about 5 or 6 big gulps of air, I pulled my shirt up to see if any bones were poking through. There weren't nothing there but 3 tiny holes where his claws had gone in, and only one hole was bleeding at all. I felt to make sure weren't nothing broke. Other than poking 3 holes in me, it seemed like the bear-fighting dog hadn't done nothing worse than knock the air out of my chest. I stood up and put 2 more chunking stones in my hand, then walked over toward the dog. One of my stones had caught him right twixt the eyes. I knowed it was the 2nd left-hand one I chunked. There was a big knot swelling up there already. His tongue was hanging out from twixt long yellow and brown teeth that were about the size of bear claws. There was a little puddle of mud spreading in the dust where his tongue was resting. I didn't think I'd hurt him too bad, but I weren't going to wait round to find out. I leaned against the door that led into the stable and pushed. When you first walk into a room in a house, or into a clearing in the woods, or into the inside of a stable like this one, they have a way of telling you they know you're there. It ain't nothing particular noticeable, but the air inside of them changes like it's saying, "I'm watching you." Some of the time it seems like the air's smiling and saying, "I'm watching over you. Come on in." And some of the time, it seems like it's all a frowning and saying, "I'm watching you, and you best be careful." But I'd got into this stable so quiet and sneakish that nothing knowed I'd cracked open the door, held my breath, and took a step inside. I eased the door back shut, stood still, and waited for my eyes to get used to the dark. All I could see was black. But going by what I was hearing, I figured there must have been 5 or 6 horses held up in here. There was the swish, swish, swish of tails going at flies. There was the bumpity bump bump of hoofs shifting and scraping whilst trying to get comfortable. There was the steady, easy, deep breathing of animals that had been worked hard trying to get some sleep. There was also a slow hoo, hoo, hoo sound from a barn owl hid out waiting for a mouse to make a mistake. It didn't sound like there was nothing to worry about, right off. I let air come out of my mouth easy and breathed back in through my nose. I'd know just like that there was something terrible wrong inside this stable. It weren't the horses. They smelt the same as Buxton horses. That weren't peculiar. It weren't the smell of the straw on the floor, neither. But I could tell that whoever's chore was to keep it clean weren't changing it regular enough. I could even smell that there was a goat or two somewhere in here. All those things were easy to tell and usual. but there was something else mixed up with the all-the-time stable smells. Something that just weren't sitting right. It weren't like a rat had curled up in a hole somewhere and died, then commenced to swelling up and rotting. But it weren't far from that. Or like a mule had ate something bad and was ailing and leaking sickness. But it was kind of akin to that. It weren't one of them sick room smells neither. One of them rooms they tell you you ain't got no choice but to go into and say goodbye to someone that looks like they should have died a year or four. But it wasn't exactly the backside of that kind of stinking. I didn't have much time to study on what the strange smell was, because my eyes started getting used to the dark and were picking out things. And when it comes to choosing to pay attention to your nose or your ears or your eyes, you gotta listen to your eyes every time. Then my heart stopped beating. My blood ran cold. And time stood still. Someone was standing over at the other end of the stable. I acted like a fawn all over again. I quit breathing and froze all my muscles dead where they were at. Maybe whoever it was hadn't seen me. My eyes were slow getting more used to the dark, and doggone it all, I started suspecting I'd knowed who I was seeing. At the other end of the stable was the Right Reverend Deacon Dr. Zephariah Connerly III, the Stealer of Dreams. But just like the smell in the stable, something went right about him. He was watching me from the other end of the stable, and I was pretty darn sure it was the preacher. But as he real slow started getting more and more lit up, and less gray and shadowish, I began doubting what I first saw. He was being too still. The preacher always had something moving on him, either his hands or his legs or, most of all, his mouth. It just weren't sitting right seeing him standing there with his arms raised up on both sides of him and his head ducked down like he was studying something in the dirt. Or maybe that wasn't it at all. Maybe he was doing the same thing I was doing, freezing every muscle so as I might not see him. We both stood still, froze that way for the longest time, waiting to see which one was going to move first. But finally, my legs took to twitching and feeling that they were about to bust out of fire. The preacher was better at this standing still business than me. He didn't move a finger. He kept his arms up there, patient as a rock, quiet as a scarecrow. But something just weren't right. I started stealing closer to him, one slow step at a time. Then I heard a humming sound so near to my left-hand side that my blang legs and breathing froze up all over again. Whatever it was that was making that sound was so close that even my eyeballs locked where they were at. I kept them straight ahead on the scarecrow that might be the preacher. Then, slow as maple sap on a cold day, I started sliding my eyes off to the left, off to the direction that the humming sound was coming from. The only thing I could make out was that someone had leaned some dark bundles or sacks up against the left-hand side of the stable. There were five of them, all sitting the same space apart, one from another. The noise commenced again, sounded like someone fishing round trying to figure which song they were about to hum. I knowed I'd best quit holding my breath, else I was going to be forced to breathe in so hard it'd make a racket. I eased air back into me like a bellows being pulled open slow and easy. I moved my eyeballs just the tiniest bit more and saw exactly what it was that was making that music hum and sound. It was one of the bundles. I ain't never gonna know if it was 'cause of the slow way air was sliding back into me, or if it was 'cause my eyes finally could make out what they were seeing. But my head got light, and before I could do anything, my senses took off, squawking and flapping away like a flock of pheasants in a field. Next thing, the stable floor felt like it was rising and dropping like a fresh dried bed sheet, being snapped and shook before it got folded. The way things were jumping round and with my wits flewed away, it didn't make no sense to try to keep standing. I knowed I'd best get a hold of something till the floor steadied itself, else I'd pitch into the dirt. But it was too late. I looked at the humming bundle again and saw that it had arms. 4 live, moving arms. 2 of them were tiny and mostly steel, and 2 of them were big and moving. I couldn't believe I'd come all the way to the United States of America to see my first hanked. I didn't have no chance to get a hold on to nothing. My legs gave out, and I crumpled toward the ground. I'd gone and got myself right in the middle of being fragile again. When your senses leave you sudden-like, and you start falling, you don't have the time nor the notion to put your hands up so as not to hit your head. Everything goes limp and flops like okra. And since your head's the thickest part of you and most times leads the way down, it's always first to bust the ground. But this time, I did remember to keep my mouth shut. Part of the floor must have had planks laid down in it, 'cause when my head hit, there was a loud sound like an axe chopping a thick oak. That one good hit to my skull made me see stars, and it was terrible loud, 'cause each and every one of those bundles that was on that wall came to life and unfolded itself with a powerful, horrible sound. The commotion they made when they moved was enough to wake the dead, not from being loud, but from being terrific. It weren't no human sound at all, but something about it did bring people to mind. It was groans and rough breathing mixed up with some of the same noise that the chain on the dog outside had made, which got me thinking I was soon about to get ripped to shreds by the brothers and sisters of the dog that I chunked. Only difference was, now the sound was times by 5 and was added to a bunch of whimpers and the hard sucking in of air. What I was seeing weren't 5 sacks at all, nor 5 dogs looking to settle scores for me chunking their brother, nor 5 evil spirits come to life. None of that. What I was seeing was worse than all those things totaled up together. What was on the wall or the stable couldn't have been nothing but 5 squatted down demons that had been captured and chained by someone who was sending them back to Satan so they couldn't snatch no one else's soul. I looked over to where the preacher was, hoping he'd do something to help, but got my attention drawn back quick to the chained demons. The 4-armed one that was humming made a shushing sound at the rest of them and started talking. Talking in English, too. It whispered out to me, "Who? Who? Is you real or is you a haint?" I lifted my head from the floor and without thinking what I was talking to said, "Pardon me, ma'am?" She was the only one amongst the bunch that looked like a woman, and I ain't sure if it was the right thing to do to call a haint ma'am, but the word came out anyway. as she got clearer and clearer looking, I wondered if she was a hanged at all. She was starting to look just about like a regular woman, but a regular woman that was afeared and had four arms. But the way her eyes locked on me, I was pretty sure this was a regular woman. I also saw she didn't have no clothes on, excepting a rag hanging across one of her shoulders. Seeing a grown-up person naked like that was so shocking that I snatched my eyes off her and looked down at the dirt in front of her feet. There were thick bands of iron hugged round her ankles, connecting up to some locks and chains that were keeping her where she was at. I was just as embarrassed to see these chains as I was to see that she didn't have no clothes on. I looked at the others so as not to shame her. The rest of them were men, and they weren't wearing nothing at all, not even a rag. Their ankles were covered with the same kind of thick iron shackles as the woman's. Their eyes were all on me, and they were looking just as scared and confused and surprised about seeing me as I was about seeing them. The four-armed woman hissed again. "Is you a real boy?" I wasn't sure how to answer her. If she was a haint and thought that I was one too, she might not do nothing to me. Besides, who else but a haint's going to have four arms? But if she weren't a haint, and I told her I was one, maybe she put some kind of haint-killing conjure on me, and I'd be dead anyway. Instead of looking at her, I put my eyes up in the rafters of the stable, which was easy to do since, whilst my mind was trying to figure out how to answer her question, I was still spread out on the floor being fragile. The waiter now stared back down at me. I figured I'd best answer her with the truth. I said, "Yes, ma'am, I'm a real boy." She whispered, "If you's a haint, get on out of here. If you's a real boy, cut that foolishness and pick yourself out of that dirt." I tried to get back on my feet. I got up, but kept my head down. A choky, coughing sound came from the woman, and I couldn't help but look. The sound was too tiny for a grown woman to be making. I saw a little black head and two little black arms coming out of the rag that was stretched out across her front. It was truly a load off my mind when I could tell that, even with it dark as it was in the stable, she didn't have four arms at all. She was a woman holding on to a baby. Then I understood. These weren't no chained demons. These were five runaway slaves and a baby that had been caught. I knowed what they were, but my head kept spinning anyway. She said, "Boy?"
"Yes, ma'am."
She said, "If you's real, go by them horses in that stall behind you and fetch that bucket of water. But keep hitched. One of them paddy roaders be over yon licked up." I looked to where she was pointing and saw another bundle on the right-hand side of the stable. Excepting for the shotgun leaned up against him, you'd never knowed it was a white man. There was a leather bucket hanging from a nail, so I went and brung it and the drinking gourd that was next to it over to where the woman with the baby was squatted down. She reached out and touched my hand like she was making sure I was real, then said, "Thank you, boy." She dipped the gourd in the water and propped the baby up so as it could get a drink. The baby hadn't showed no signs of being alive past a cough or two, but once it saw the water, it sprung up and commenced kicking its legs straight out and clawing at the gourd and sucking and slurping and lapping at the water like it hadn't had nothing to drink in 2 years. The sound of the baby going out the water stirred the men up something fierce. Two of them reached their hands out at me and strained up against their chains so's to get close to the bucket as they could. The woman mashed her finger against her lips and said, "Hish them chains! You wants to wake that white man and get this here boy killed? There's plenty of water here. Just you wait." She waved her hand round a lot whilst she was talking to the man, like they couldn't hear her good. She eased the gourd away from the baby and said, "There now, darling, go slow. Ain't no point making yourself sick." But the child wasn't having none of her cautions. It snatched back at the gourd and bit on the side of it, breathing in water, splashing its mouth round like a sparrow in a puddle. The baby commenced coughing again, and the woman took the gourd away. She dipped it back in the bucket and took a long pull herself. Two more times she did this, draining the gourd dry, then taking a breath so deep and so hard that it brung to mind someone who'd dived under a lake, then come back up right afore their lungs were about to bust. She said, "Thank you. Thank you kindly. Now, give them men some." I stepped over to the man closest to her and set the bucket in front of him. He looked at it, then looked up at me. He raised his hands, and I saw that his arms were tied up with heavy chains that were dangling off of his wrists. I didn't know what to say or do. Ma and Pa and all the grown folks in the settlement had told us plenty of stories about folks in chains afore. And a couple of people in Buxton even had thick, shiny scars on their ankles and wrists from wearing them. But seeing the chains real weren't the kind of thing you could imagine. It weren't the kind of picture that words could paint. Maybe the grown folks were trying not to scare us when they told stories about folks being chained up. 'Cause judging by the way these people looked, I'd know we weren't getting the whole story. I felt my legs getting unsolid and rickety all over again. The woman said, "Boy, it's just my hands what's free, so's I can tend my child. Them men's arms is chained. They can't reach their mouth. You's gonna have to help 'em." I dipped the gourd into the water and raised it to the man's lips so he could drink. His eyes were blood red and swole up and crusted so's you'd have thought he'd had a good, long, hard cry. But there was something in his eyes that told you that this weren't the kind of man that was likely to be bawling, no matter what happened to him. Things had run out of his nose and were making the hair on his lip look gray. But up close, he seemed too young to be showing age that way. He was too strong-looking. He was one of them men that's got every muscle poking right out of him. Sort of like, if you weren't careful, they'd come ripping right through his skin. His lips were cracked with long, bloody splits, dividing them every little bit. His hair was caked up on one side with blood or mud, like he got chunked there by a rock and never took the time to wash it out. He had one of his legs stretched out front of him, and there was a big rip out of the skin by his knee. It had got sewed up, but not real good. It must have been from that bear-fighting dog. He ducked his head at me once, then drank just as hard as the woman and the child. She said, "He the child's paw. Him and them other threes, all full-blood Africans. He don't talk a whole lot of English, but he ain't lost his manners so much that he ain't gonna say thank you kindly. How'd you come out?" The man ducked his head again. I said, "You're welcome, sir." And once he had his fill, I went down the line watering the other men. The last one weren't a man at all. He was a boy that looked like he was a little younger than me. His eyes were red and swollen up and crusted, too. But there weren't no doubt what caused this on him. It was crying. Even dark as it was, I could still see the gray tracks the tears that had run down his cheeks left. His nose was crusted up and leaking even more than the man's. It was terrible to see. When he looked up at me, all I could think to do was pull my hand up in my sleeve, then reach my cuff over to wipe his nose and mouth off. He saw me raise my hand and flinched back, like he was expecting me to bust him in the face. But he saw what I was trying to do and leaned in. Soon as I wiped his nose, I gave him some of the water. Once he had his fill, he bent down and pulled my arm so as my hand was at his lips. He pressed his mouth there. It ripped at my inside something harsh. He was acting like giving him a drink of water weren't no different than giving him a $20 gold piece. He wouldn't turn my hand loose. He started mumbling some African talk against it, then commenced to crying and quiet, jerking noises that made his teeth rub up against my skin and made the chains on his arms and legs rattle. I pulled my hand away, and all of a sudden, I noted what the odd smell in the stable was. It was fear. It was the smell of 5 grown folks and 1 baby that were afeared of everything. And that smell and the sight of these chain folks and the sounds they made every time they moved started making me sick to my stomach. I know it don't seem right, but all I wanted to do was get away from this boy, to get away from these people afore I throwed up. I left the bucket at the boy's feet and stumbled 3 steps backward. The woman whispered, "No, child. You's got to put it back just like it was. You's got to leave it like ain't no one been in here." When I got the bucket and gourd back, she said, "Come close and keep your voice down. What you doing here? You work in this stable?" They scared me so bad I plumb forgot about the preacher. I remembered what I swore to Mr. Leroy and told her, "No, ma'am. I'm searching for the man that stole my friend's money." I looked to the other end of the stable, and the preacher was still standing there, pretending he weren't hearing none of this. I drawed Mr. Leroy's pistol out of my tote sack so as the preacher could see this weren't no bluff, and said a little louder, "He's going to give me Mr. Leroy's money back, else I'm gut shooting him down like a mad yellow dog." Having a gun in your hand when you knowed you were going to use it to shoot a human person made it feel a whole lot different. When I'd used the preacher's old rusty gun to shoot stumps and stones, it didn't feel nowhere near as heavy as this one. The mystery pistol was shaking and sliding back and forth in my hand, same as a weather vane in a January storm. The 4 Africans drawed back once they saw that gun, and the way it was jumping round in my hand. You could tell they knowed what a pistol like this one could do to somebody. The woman said, "Now I seen everything. A boy holding a man's gun fixing to shoot someone. But if you set on killing that man, you's too late, child. Look at there. He breathed his last just for sunset. Had quite the mouth on him, that one did. I knowed they weren't taking him nowhere. I knowed when they brung him in here and bust his teeth out and split his tongue in 2. They ain't never gonna treat no one what they's looking to sell like that. What they done with him was nothing but play, nothing but sport. But you tell your friend if that man stole something from him, he done paid a terrible price for it. You tell him that man stayed alive way past what you'd have thought someone could,
and he never begged. And he cursed them paddy rollers with every blow they put on him. Cursed him right to the end. So the Right Reverend Deacon Dr. Zephariah Connolly III was dead. I was shamed, 'cause, wrong as it might seem, the first thing that came flooding into my heart was reliefness, 'cause that meant I weren't going to have to keep my word and kill him. I could see now it was ropes that were keeping the preacher's arms spread out to the sides. He was strung up twixt two beams. Another rope was wrapped round and round his neck and was pinching his throat narrow and tight. I knowed I were never going to be able to look at Emma's old doll Birdie again without calling up thoughts about the preacher. The next thing that came into my heart made it sink right down into my brogans. There weren't no clothes on the preacher, excepting for a bloody rag round his knees. Mr. Leroy's money must be all gone. The woman said, "Put that thing down for you hurt someone." I put the preacher's gun back in my tote sack. She said, "Who you belongs to?" She could see I was having a powerful hard time taking my eyes off the preacher, so she pulled at my arm. When I still couldn't quit looking at him, she turned my face so as I was looking dead at her. "Who you belongs to?" The only thing I could think to say was, "No one, ma'am. I'm my ma and pa's boy." She said, "You sure do talk peculiar. Where you born? You from this here town?" I said, "No, ma'am. I was born free in the Buxton settlement in Canada West." "Canada?" "Yes, ma'am." She said, "How far's us from Canada?" It took me and Mr. Leroy near about an hour to ride it, but we weren't tarrying at all. We were probably riding the horse too hard. She said, "A hour?" "Yes, ma'am." "No. Say that ain't the truth. Say that a lie, boy." "No, ma'am. That's the swear for God truth." For the first time since I met her, she smiled. She held the baby away from her and said, "Honey, I guess we just snake bit. We run all that time and falls 1 little hour short. 1 hour, child. We was that close. I spec we so close, we might even be breathing that free Canada air." I started to tell her that mostly the wind blows the other way, from America over into Canada. But I figured that wasn't what she was talking about. I said, "Where's that man taking you, ma'am?" She said, "I expect me and Kamau and the baby's heading back to my missus in Kentucky. I can't say where they taking them other three. They don't talk no English at all. And Kamau say they don't talk the same African he do." I remembered all the stories we'd heard in classes about abolitionists and how they'd risk their lives for people who were just like these folks. I remembered how those stories got you so excited and mad and worked up that you wanted to charge down into America and free all the slaves. I remember how those stories near about made you cry when the grown folks would tell you how they felt when they finally got to Buxton and they pressed their left hands onto the Liberty Bell and they finally knowed how it felt not to be owned by nobody. I thought about all the times me and Cuda and Emma and our friends played abolitionists and slavers. The way we had to pull straws to see who would get to be the abolitionist, 'cause didn't no one want to pretend to be somebody bad as a slave owner. I remembered how we'd act like we were sneaking up on a plantation
to kill the lot of slave masters and make a run for Canada with some happy, smiling, free slaves. I remembered how easy it all was. But now I could see our plan didn't have nothing to do with the truth. I could see how it was a whole lot harder when things were real, and you had to worry about shotguns and chains and coughing little babies and crying folks without no clothes. Folks that were the same as me and Ma and Pa. Excepting they were near dead. Excepting they gave off a sad, peculiar smell. Excepting they were chained in a way that I ain't never seen even the wildest, worstest animal chained. I knowed right then that if I got out of this stable in Michigan alive, I were never gonna play abolitionist again. Not just 'cause all the fun had been took out of it, but mostly 'cause I knowed I weren't brave enough to even pretend to be one of them. I knowed it would be kind of like pretending you were an angel. It was the kind of thing that would make you shamed the next time you ran into a real angel or a real abolitionist. It was the kind of thing that shouldn't be involved in no sort of game. I looked at the woman and swore to myself, shotguns and chains or not, I was going to figure a way to get her and these Africans out of here.
Chapter 22. Busting Free.
I asked the woman, "How many of 'em is it that's stealing you, ma'am?" She said, "They's that one pass out yawn, and one what they calls Prater and his two boys, and a ornery dog." I calculated real quick, swallowed hard so's there wouldn't be no backing down, and said, "Ma'am, I can creep up on that man that's asleep and try to get the keys to those locks away without rousing him. And if he does wake up and I got to use this gun, then I got to use this gun. Then I'll let you all loose, and we'll have a shotgun, too. And when those other slave hunters come running, we all could..." Ideas were jumping at me hard and fast, and it seemed like the more harder and more faster they came, the more they were bumping into one another, and the more confusing and worthless they were sounding, even to me. But I couldn't quit talking. Quitting talking was the same as quitting everything, so I said, "And when we get to Buxton, the folks will welcome you and help you set up a farm. Even some of the white folks will help. And we're always looking out for people who are trying to get free. And when you get there, me and Cooter are going to ring the Liberty Bell around 100 times. That comes out to 20 times for each one of you. And don't no paddy rollers come there, else they get tarred and feathered and run out of town on a rail. Or they disappear, and ain't never heard from no more. And even the white folks that don't want us there get mighty riled when Americans come into Canada and try to tell them what to do. And once we get there, Emma Collins ain't gonna have to trick you out of the woods, 'cause I'ma bring you all the way there myself, and I..." I looked over at the four other people who were back to leaning their heads twixt their knees, and breathing in a way that told me they weren't going to run nowhere. They didn't look like a bunch of tired, beat-down people no more. They were back to looking like 5 bundles throwed up against a stable wall. It was too much. Mr. Leroy dying, the preacher getting killed, the smells, the way the chains rattled, and the naked folks looking so scared and whooped and tired, it was just too much. The stupid and confusing ideas quit coming and got their place took by a stinging in my eyes and a loosening in my nose and a choking in my throat. It wasn't nothing but some powerful fragileness, and when it comes, there ain't nothing you can do to stop it. It's like a ball got rolling down a hill. So all I could do was cry.